College holds a mythic place in American culture. But there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday at this hour, and we appreciate that. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Guy, there is so much going on, and so many things are moving so quick with this administration, thinking about what's going on in Ukraine, the Middle East, this, that, and then, you know, some of the most recent releases about labor and where we are with our central bank rates as opposed to the rest of the world. So let's start, I guess, with the labor market. What's going on?
Yeah, really an interesting number. And the number was pretty shocking. U.S. job growth, 73,000 in the month, and that was a revision downward. And the thing that most concerned the administration is the prior 2 months were revised downward, and the revisions were so stark that the president fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, it's not her fault that the numbers were revised down, but there is a legitimate reason to be upset with Bureau of Labor Statistics because they use surveys to estimate unemployment. So they do a household survey, they do a company survey, and for years, survey responses have been declining. I mean, if you think about it, you know, do you answer surveys at home? You know, I certainly don't. If I don't know the number, I don't pick up the phone. Companies have continued to reduce their response rate. So the data is really not very accurate, and it's only months later when you get the real payroll data that you know for sure what's what. And what happened is when the real data came in, it turned out that payroll growth was nowhere near as strong as the administration had hoped and projected or that anyone wanted. So it was a big shock. Firing the head of the Statistics Bureau, maybe an overreaction. It's not her fault. But then again, I think that she and the Bureau should have pushed harder to link payroll data and have real-time data, because that's a real problem. We have real-time data. You know, our bank, every other employer has to report people that are employed, but relying on surveys when you could insist upon real-time data, I think it creates a problem, and it results in this sort of statistical anomaly. But underneath all this, the job market is weak. So that's a challenge for the administration, challenge for the United States.
Before we talk about the job market being weak, let us talk about the data and the dissemination of the data. There's a lag, right, before we actually have the payroll data. Is that correct?
There is, and there doesn't need to be. I mean, that's the challenge.
Okay. Because I was going to ask, how do we make the transition? Because obviously, you know, it's like almost set in stone that they're going to release this data. But if we want to get more aligned with the payroll data, do we have to, like, create a delay in order to get this transition? And what's the likelihood of us being able to, for the most part, mostly eliminate survey responses? Because they're not very reliable. I mean, people don't fill that stuff out anymore. I mean,
no, of course not.
We still have that in this business, doing it by mail. I mean, you know, it's like.
Yeah, and the situation is every employer has to do payroll withholding. We have to report to Social Security, the IRS, when people are hired. First thing you do, first day when you get your new job, you sit down with payroll. They do your withholding. And then every 2 weeks, we send a report in of how much we've withheld. So we could have very accurate data. And the requirement is simply to change the government computers and also to tell employers, look, you've got to add a couple of data fields that you're reporting on a biweekly basis. And I'm not suggesting this is easy. You're moving data across a lot of different systems. But if it's something you decide is important, it could easily be done. And then we'd have real-time, very good data. And that would be that's very important for companies, for planning, and for the government. So it's something that the administration should insist on with a new head of Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's not about creating Chinese statistics where the government says we're going to grow 5% and then all the provinces send in 5% growth targets. You know, those numbers are completely imaginary. And you have the same thing with countries like Venezuela and Russia where the statistics are unreliable. What we want to do is have the gold standard of accurate numbers, and it's doable. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's something we should deliberately insist upon and focus on because it really makes decision-making a lot better, and having real-time numbers would be something that we should strive to achieve. And I think it's something that if you really make a target, you can do that within 6 months to a year.
Guy, is it fair to say that part of the importance of this is that the release of this data tends to either boost confidence or diminish confidence, right?
It does, and it's also information that the Federal Reserve uses to make decisions. Now, if the Federal Reserve had known 2 months ago that the job market is as weak as it is, I think there's a likelihood they would have cut 2 months ago. And that has real-life consequences because Federal Reserve rate affects mortgage rates, affects interest rates on car loans, commercial loans, also affects savings rates. So if real-time data allows the Fed to get their adjustments in rates better synced to the economy, they can do their job better. And look, sometimes it's going to result in the rate having to go up more quickly, but that's also been a problem because in the past we had times where the rate stayed too low for too long, and it really hurt the economy going forward and created inflationary pressure. So getting real-time data would be very important, and that'd be something I would push very hard on. And we really ought to insist. I mean, the U.S. is a premier economy in the world. We should have the most accurate and the most timely economic statistics as well.
I don't know about you, I mean, but it's very disappointing to hear that, you know, we're supposed to be the leader in this and that and technology, and yet we hear repeatedly over and over and over again that we're not, that we're less than. And it's kind of disappointing, you know,
Well, it is, and I think part of it is just not demanding higher quality. I mean, we really should insist that our government institutions do a super job. And, you know, the government can do a great job when they set their mind to it. I think I told you I needed to get a passport because I didn't quite have the 6 months needed for a trip, and went to the Passport Bureau right here in New Orleans at the end of Canal Street, brought them the data in the morning. They said, we'll call you on your cell phone when it's ready. And I'm thinking, wait, this is a government agency? And son of a gun, 11 o'clock, they called and said, okay, we're all set. And I said, well, I'm at lunch right now. I'll be there at 1 o'clock. So came in, got it done. I mean, this is an example. They've linked the systems. They were able to check, make sure it was me. They got everything they needed and literally reissued it same day, you know, within 4 hours. So that's the sort of efficiency we can get to. Air traffic control is another area. We absolutely have to have efficiency. If you go out to the airport and you notice a concrete building next to the runway, that's a building that holds vacuum tubes running the ILS, the instrument landing system. And administrations have talked about changing it. They get bids out, then they don't do it. And I think that's something that if you're running the government, you're in charge, you need to insist, we're going to run this business efficiently. It's important to the citizens. They're paying their taxes. They need to see a good return on the money that's spent.
So let's talk about the job numbers. 73,000 new jobs added. Obviously, I guess most of the sectors suffered.
They really did. And No, before we get into the sectors, I want to not bury the lead, because there's a great series of data information put out by Arizona State University, and they do jobs by state. So if you go to that sector, you'll see that South Carolina was wonderful. They were number one. You'll see that Maine, Massachusetts were terrible. Maine was number 50. But the important story for us, Louisiana was number 16 in job growth. Texas was number 17. We always talk about our friends to the west. We were 16, they were 17. So we're adding jobs as a percentage basis slightly faster than Texas. So really good news for the state of Louisiana. And that's the benefit of all of the natural gas plants that are going up, the pipelines that are being done, and our oil and gas industry. So great news for Louisiana. Slightly less good news, not slightly less, but significantly worse news. New Orleans lost jobs in that year. So state gained. We're number 16 out of 50. City of New Orleans lost 900 jobs year over year. So it really makes it important. You know, we have a mayoral race going on right now. I just strongly encourage everybody, pick a forum or two and go listen to the candidates live. Hear what they have to say. Make your decision. It's a great privilege to be able to see the candidates live. But if you don't do it and you don't go and ask questions, then you really shouldn't be whining and complaining later, because this is a wonderful privilege we have in a democracy to go hear and see. And they're all going to tell you that they want to improve the economy. But you need to look at them, listen, and ask how specifically they're going to improve it. And then decide for yourself which one has the most credible plan.
Yep. I said that in my monologue this morning. You know, that there's a lot that we're not talking about that we really should be talking about. All right. So as a country, healthcare was always the one of the biggest drivers, and government was second to healthcare in driving. Did that change in this most recent report?
Healthcare is still the biggest driver. Retail is going up. Federal employment slightly down. And it's important to remember, we hear an awful lot about federal employment declining, and it has declined. But federal employment is 1% smaller than its peak. And I'm not unsympathetic. I'm sorry when anyone loses their job, but the federal government has not shrunk significantly. It's shrunk about 1%. So federal is down a little bit, but it's being made up by state and local. So government employment is still going up slightly. Manufacturing is down, and that's a challenge. And that's something that nobody wants to see. The administration's not fond of. And if I were on the Council of Economic Advisors, I would suggest that, look, you put the tax thing behind you. So now the tax cuts are permanent, but you've got to put tariffs behind you. People cannot plan until they know for sure what the tariff levels are going to be to build a plant. So we're seeing this sort of indecision with people waiting to see. Because you can't make a decision. Because building a plant, you expect it to last 30 to 50 years. You have to have certainty. And I think that lack of certainty is a challenge. The other thing that's a little scary is the workforce is smaller today than it was in January. So we have fewer people that are in the workforce. And that's an unfortunate trend. And it's particularly unfortunate as you look at this class of 25, the recent graduates. So they're seeing a significant challenge in getting new employment. And that's going to be something going forward, because if you don't get a good first job, a decade later you find that you're always behind the cohorts that came out when hiring was really good. So we're seeing a big challenge for new graduates, where they're actually seeing higher unemployment than the rest of the population. And so we're looking at that and thinking, okay, this is going to be a challenge going forward. The other challenge is something like 54% of new graduates are getting jobs that don't really require college degrees. And so you've spent money, in some cases you have significant debt, but you have a job that you really did not need to go to college for. And that's a problem going forward, because you put yourself in a situation where you've paid money, taken 4 years off, or sometimes five or six, and you're not actually getting a job that required a college degree. So that's something that is a challenge, the AI challenge of a lot of companies when they talk about AI on their earnings call, say AI is going to enable us to reduce headcount. And to the extent it creates efficiency, it'll ultimately be good for the economy. But in the short run, if you're one of the people that's not getting a job because of the reduced headcount, then that really is a difficult situation.
Guy, let me ask this question. Do you buy that? Because I don't really buy that in the short term, and I'll tell you why. And you would know better than me. IT systems, once you become beholden to them, they are really difficult to keep them up to date, alive, and well. And almost everyone I talk to is having a real difficult time hiring people to manage their IT systems. What are you hearing?
Definitely true. Specialized IT data security, because of the increase in fraud, is a big problem. I think what we're seeing, though, is the AI is not replacing the IT jobs as much as it's replacing some of the customer service jobs.
Somebody's got to manage that AI, is what I'm saying. Who's?
Oh yeah, they do.
Where are these people coming from that are going to manage? Because the day to day, just managing, you know, the desktops in a business like yours, those people are getting hard to find these days.
They are, and that gets to the mismatch of skills and jobs. There's mm-hmm. a bit of a mismatch where people have degrees in areas that are not conducive to employment. You know, one poor lady that had a Yale degree in psychology said, you know, I've sent out 500 resumes and I haven't gotten anybody to call me back. And that's frustrating, and, you know, you wish her the best, but sometimes there's a mismatch between what's demanded and what's available. What companies are saying is AI is going to reduce the number of entry-level people they have. They're able to do some of that just sort of sorting of data with AI. So it's not that they're going to lay people off. They're just going to hire more slowly. And that could be the case. You know, the accounting firm consulting firm McKinsey & Company said they're using a lot of AI for just routine data sorting. And it reduces the number of first-year folks that they need to hire. So I think we're seeing an incremental effect rather than a reduction of staff right at the moment. Yeah. But if you're the one who's not getting hired, that's the same effect.
No doubt. We got to get to a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the divergence between U.S. central bank rates and what the rest of the world is doing. Stay with us. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, we had a caller, I think, who's called a couple of times over the past several weeks about the utilization of cryptocurrency in a 401k or as collateral for a mortgage.
Yeah, I would really discourage both of those for a couple of reasons. Let's imagine you're using it as collateral. Crypto has nothing that supports its value. You know, unlike gold, which is a bit of an inflation hedge and has had demand for 4,000 years, this is brand new. We don't know how it'll react in a downturn. It literally could go to zero because there is no reason to own crypto. It doesn't, you don't earn interest on it. And unless somebody else wants to pay more, it's not going to go up in value. And there's so many different crypto coins that it's hard to imagine which one's going to last, which one won't. So I'm afraid calling it an asset class is a bit speculative. On the 401k, you're betting on your whole future. What I would tell young people is max out your 401k. And if you don't know what else to do, just put it all in an S&P 500 or a total U.S. market index. And then as you get closer to retirement, switch to a balanced index. You know, look for a great fund that has low cost. But that is far safer. The crypto may look good, but I would not want to do that because it conceivably could go to zero.
All righty. So let's talk about the divergence between U.S. central bank rates and the rest of the world. There seems to be a pretty big delta between the two.
Oh, yeah, there really is. Our rates, we have a range, 4.25 to 4.50. The Eurozone, 2.15. The U.K., 4%. Japan, 0.5. China, 3%. South Korea, 2.5%. Russia's an outlier at 18. Switzerland's a real outlier at 0. So what's happening? Our central bank has waited. They're, as they say, data-dependent. You and I talked in the first part of the hour. Some of the data may be inaccurate they've been waiting on, particularly the employment number, because they have a dual mandate, high employment and low inflation. So we've been perhaps waiting on data and getting inaccurate information. So that's one thing that's kept us out of the rate-reducing area that the other central banks have gotten into. The other thing is, you know, our central bank and their economists believe, I mean, they absolutely believe it in their heart of hearts that tariffs are inflationary. And they keep waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it hasn't dropped yet. And I think what's happening is consumers are substituting for imported goods that tend to, that have gone up because of tariffs. They're buying other things, and consumers always have that option. There are very few things that you just can't get anywhere else. I mean, one of the few is coffee. And we just don't grow much coffee in the U.S., but with the absence of things like coffee and avocados, you can substitute something else. So we're not seeing tariffs create inflation the way the economists at the Fed think it will, and they're waiting on something that may not occur. So they perhaps are behind the curve right now just because of bad data. And when you have the highest rate among the developed countries, it does create distortions because then, you know, money flows into your market and people are buying your securities because of the higher yield. And some of these other countries are seeing lower yields and lower mortgage costs, lower borrowing costs for their economy.
I meant to ask you, and it kind of relates to this question earlier on the jobs report, and I'm sure you might have seen the story in the Post, the Washington Post, about, you know, this hybrid work where, you know, part-time, you're at home, you come into the office 1 or 2 days a week, that a lot of companies are stepping down on that, and people are, like, they're quitting because they've set up this lifestyle from the pandemic that they don't want it to change. Do you think that has is that maybe one driver of what we're seeing in these job numbers?
It is, and we've got a couple of things that are going on that are sort of hurting the U.S. market. We used to have tremendous mobility in the U.S., and that was one of the great strengths of our economy, is people would leave one area and go to another for a better job. We saw that in Louisiana during the oil booms. Tremendous number of people moved to Louisiana. And, of course, when there was an oil bust, then a number of people left Louisiana. But that labor mobility really gave the U.S. economy a lot of flexibility. Now people are resisting that. It's much lower than it's been in 20 years. The work from home is part of that. People have created a lifestyle where they're not willing to move. And, you know, Jamie Dimon at Chase was pretty emphatic about, look, y'all need to come to work. I just built this big, expensive office building in downtown Manhattan, and I'm tired of walking around on Fridays and seeing nobody here. So he's really insisting that people come in to work. And a lot of folks just don't want to do it. They don't like to commute. They like having Friday afternoons off where they pretend to work, and then after lunch on Friday, they're not really working. So there's a push and pull between what the employees want and what the employers want. But I'd caution young employees, particularly, if you don't go to work, you really are going to have a hard time progressing in your career, because you're not going to meet your colleagues, you're not going to get the interaction, you're not going to understand the unwritten things that are true at every company. You know, every company has real policies, and then they have the actual policies that aren't written down anywhere, where, okay, this is what you actually need to do to succeed in this company, and these are the people that really work. So I think the work from home is, for some people, valuable, but not for anywhere near as many as would like to work from home. And I would even caution those who are working from home, for goodness sake, try and schedule a certain amount of time in the office, because if you're not meeting your colleagues, it's going to be very difficult to progress in your career and to make the connections you need.
So, you know, when you think about what Jamie Dimon says, he builds his big building in New York. Let's pivot real quick to the New York economy. There's a lot of uncertainty as a result of this mayor's race that's going on at the present time. How does that economy there impact not only elections, national party, but just the whole mindset, Wall Street and the like?
Well, New York is incredibly important. It's one of the great world cities, wonderful place to visit. But New York is also very, very important politically to the Democratic Party. You know, in the state of Louisiana, we are inordinately fortunate to have Steve Scalise and Mike Johnson in influential positions on the House side. In the Democratic Party, you have Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, both from New York, running the House and the Senate side for the Democrats. So the top positions are both New Yorkers. And you now have a mayor's race with somebody who's running on the extreme left. And this matters because New York sets the tone for the rest of the Democratic Party. And if the party sees that running on the extreme left is a winning ticket, you'll see more extreme left candidates running and attempting to represent different folks. And what's happening when you connect the dots, we talked about unemployment. New York City is one of the leading cities with underemployed college graduates. So we talked about more than 50% of the college graduates take jobs that don't require a college degree. That's even higher in New York. And so you have people that have gotten degrees. They're sharing space with two or three roommates because it's very expensive to live in New York. They're working as a barista, maybe a chef, maybe in some cases delivery drivers, you know, an assistant at an art gallery, lots of jobs that don't require a degree. And these people are very frustrated, and understandably so. You have student debt. You're looking over the future. You don't think you'll ever be able to afford to buy a house. You know that if you have kids, daycare costs are ridiculously high in New York City, and that's all after tax. And so you think to yourself, well, anything is better than this. We have to change. And so when someone comes along and promises to freeze the rent, lower your grocery costs, give you free subway passes and bus fare, that's very attractive. And so a lot of the underemployed people in New York are the backbone of the Mondami campaign. And right now, he's the odds-on favorite to win. And one of the latest poll had him at 50% and Cuomo in the mid-20s. And, you know, that's sort of a scary number, because every place socialism's been tried, whether it was Cuba, Venezuela, the former Soviet Union, it never works. And if this guy gets elected, it's going to encourage the party to select more people like him to run. And that's very unfortunate for the U.S. economy, because to the extent they get elected, they just don't succeed. And, I mean, you look at countries, China's an interesting one. Their college graduate unemployment rate is triple ours. And they're literally companies that are called pretend-to-work companies. And you pay a few yuan a day to go to an office where there are computers, and you can take pictures and send it to your family and say, look, here I am. But you don't have a job. You're literally paying to be somewhere where it can look like you have a job. So when you have underemployment, when you have a New York economy that's struggling, it tends to lead toward radical candidates. And, you know, the cost of living, as I said, is very high because it's very difficult to build something new in New York. And the cost of utilities is incredibly high. You know, New York has created a lot of their own problems, one of which is because they're so focused on green, they've made uneconomic decisions. They closed the Shoreham nuclear plant. Well, that actually increased global warming, but it was something that appealed to the Greens. But they refused to allow fracking in New York. So you've got abundant natural gas right next door in Pennsylvania and underneath New York, and New York won't take advantage of it. So it's really creating a challenge. So now New Yorkers, the young voters that are so fired up about going socialist, they're policies of supporting extreme green raise their cost of living. So you've got high utility cost, high rent cost, congestion, and the area that's booming in New York right now is new restaurants. You know, they're doing great. Lots of restaurants are open. Retail space for restaurants is at a premium. And that's where some of these college kids are going that have a college degree that are working in things that don't require it. And these are also the same people that are voting for Mamdani, which pushes the National Party to the left.
We got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank Trust. We will be right back.
College holds a mythic place in American culture, but there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Folks, stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. You know, guys, you laid out how important this New York mayor's race is and the economy in New York is for a whole host of reasons. There are a lot of people, including myself sometimes, that kind of think, well, why don't we just let them elect this guy Mamdani and let the chips fall where they may? And we have a lot of folks that are saying, well, you know, he's the only guy that's talking about affordability, and he has a plan, according to Senator Elizabeth Warren. So I went looking for the plan over the weekend. There's a bunch of sound bites. There's no plan. I mean, it's like, you know, tax the rich. That's not a plan. I mean, you know, so it's, you kind of wonder, okay, where are we going to go from here?
Yeah, unfortunately, the plan is based upon envy. And the idea is we're going to have both a higher income tax on the wealthy and a wealth tax on millionaires. Because if you listen carefully, there's always a distinction. We're going to tax people that are making a lot of money. So we'll have a separate higher corporate and income tax, and then a tax on millionaires, which in New York is a fair number of people, but it also would encourage folks to leave. And Michael Bloomberg, who is certainly no conservative, said, look, I understand that, but if only a percent of the billionaires leave New York, tax revenue will decline, and your problem will be significantly worse because billionaires can be mobile. Most of them have multiple homes. So he's appealing to greed, and Unfortunately, a lot of the New York voters don't really apply logic. A friend from Energy went up to New York when they had a brownout, and they said, look, we need dependable power, we need the power to be inexpensive, and we need y'all to come up with a solution. I said, okay, well, you know, we need to extend the Indian Point nuclear plant's operating license because that's our cheapest, most environmentally – oh, no, we don't want you to do that. It's too close to New York. And they said, well, we didn't move it. It's where it always was. So, no, we need to close that. Okay, well, we can bring hydropower down from Canada, but we're going to need clear right-of-ways for high-tension lines. Well, we can't do that because it'd go through forest and green space. So, well, we could underground it, but that is incredibly expensive per mile. Oh, no, we can't do that. It's too expensive. And my friend said, okay, y'all think that through. We're going to go back to New Orleans, and we'll be thinking, too, and maybe we can come up with something. Because they realized what they wanted was imaginary. You know, clean power, cheap power, yeah. Dependable power, and it can't be done. So, well, we can do solar. I said, okay, that's great. We need acres and acres of solar farms. Well, we don't have acres and acres to give you. Well,
right.
It also is not that sunny in New York year-round. So the irrationality of the voter is a challenge, and I think that's one of the problems. The politicians haven't been honest with the voters and explained the real choices. New York could be much more affordable if you waived all of the restrictions on new building and said, look, we're going to grant permits within 3 months. If it's zoned appropriately, you're going to be permitted to build new stuff.
Guy, let us pivot real quick. I want to, because you piqued my interest. There's one more topic I want to touch on, fake jury duty. What's going on there?
Sure. Yeah, the fraudsters are always looking for the newest thing. They send out an oversized envelope, and it says, you have failed to show up for jury duty. Therefore, you are subject to arrest. And what you need to do is scan this QR code or go to this website and pay your fine immediately to avoid being arrested. Well, jury duty fines don't come that way. You're not subject to being arrested. It can be a problem if you don't show up for jury duty, but they're not going to send you a QR code. And when you do the QR code, they're not asking you to send gift cards, but this has been hitting both electronically and in hard copy. And you can call the Register of Voters and say, look, I just want to check on my jury duty status. Have I missed something? But this is something that's hitting. A lot of people are falling for it, and they're getting folks to pay fines that don't exist in order to avoid being arrested.
Crazy the amount of scams that are going on, as always. We really appreciate you joining us today, Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Have a great week.
Oh, you too. Good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us.
College holds a mythic place in American culture, but there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.